As working people struggle to rebuild after the devastating wildfires in Hawaii, the systems of colonialism that created the climate crisis continue to be exacerbated. Hello, guys, and welcome to another episode of Thinking Out Loud. It's been a little while since the last episode. This month of September, I'm really trying to get back in the swing of things, start producing some more content for you guys. And a little addendum, and I won't spend too much time talking about my personal life, but it's just been a lot with work recently. It's been fulfilling, but it's been a lot. But it looks like my hours are going to be reeling back a little bit this month. So I'm hoping to kind of get back in that new groove with you guys and producing content, because there are plenty of important and highly interesting topics to be discussing right now as we go into fall and the end of the year, right? There's BRICS. Obviously, there's the fires in Maui, which we're going to be talking about today. There's some developments going on in Ukraine and just a whole host of other topics that I've kind of had, you know, boiling, simmering in a pot back here in the back of my brain that I'm hoping I can talk to you guys about here soon. So without further ado, we're going to jump right into this discussion today. So by now, you guys, of course, have undoubtedly, you know, seeing all the news coverage, probably ad nauseum about the fires in Maui, the discussion around what's happened in Maui, you know, in the media anyways, gets talked about maybe a, you know, faulty electrical grid. You know, some of that may have been a contributing factor. You'll hear some pundits and media outlets talking about invasive species of non-native grass and grasses that are, you know, more flammable. They're not, you know, a part of this, you know, biome or this environment in Hawaii, and that has, you know, created a situation where it dries out and then causes these wildfires that spread rapidly. So you probably heard some of the discussion around what's happening in Maui with a focus on, you know, those sort of separate but related issues as to what may have caused it. You may be hearing also some discussion about some negligence on behalf of FEMA or the federal government, but also state institutions. Like, there's been some discussion about how it doesn't seem like the emergency alarms went off as the fires really started to spread and get close to the community, like in Lahaina. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. So you've probably seen all these different things. I'm not going to talk too much about some of the more details with the fire in Lahaina or on the island in general. I'm going to kind of try to zoom out how we do on this channel, and I'm going to try to have a larger, broader discussion with you guys about what systemically caused these fires in Maui and really what's causing a lot of these catastrophic, you know, particularly the wildfires, but catastrophic, you know, climate weather-related events around the world. Like, what is the root cause of that? And as you can tell from the thumbnail and the title of the video, the case I'm going to be making is that colonialism, specifically colonialism, is what has gotten us into this ecological crisis recently. So jumping into this video, we're going to be going through a few articles here, a couple of articles, and then a sort of press release from the White House. The first article we're going to talk about gets into some of the details of the fire itself, what they think were the, you know, triggering factors that caused the fire and then exacerbated the fire. And then that article also gives a little bit of analysis as to how colonialism kind of set the roots for these things. And then, of course, I'll provide some commentary and analysis to build on that. And then we'll get into the White House press release that talks about, you know, what the U.S. government is, you know, ostensibly doing to take care of the situation. We're going to obviously be discussing why that doesn't go far enough, why it ends up being a Band-Aid. And really, it's pretty paltry, some of the things that they're trying to get through right now or are having go through right now. I mean, of course, it's still early on. We'll see what comes in the next weeks and months. You know, Biden has talked about this being a long game. Of course, we'll see the federal government under any administration has a pretty poor track record with dealing with these sort of natural disasters, and a track record which only seems to be getting worse as the prevalency of these sort of disasters becomes more regular or more normal. So we'll be getting into that, kind of dissecting some of that, and then we'll be rounding off the video with a more deeper analysis of how colonialism has created a lot of these environmental catastrophes, including things like floods, the wildfires, obviously, and desertification as well. So we're going to be diving into this here, guys. I'll pull up this first article here for you guys. We'll do some reading. So this one's from Mother Jones. Mother Jones can be a pretty good source. It depends. It has a generally left perspective, but it doesn't completely shake off some of the liberal paradigm of thinking. But still, every once in a while, we have some reasonable analysis out of there. Mother Jones here says, how colonialism contributed to the Maui wildfires. This is from Henry Carnell. Unsurprisingly, the disaster may be worse because of actions by U.S. colonists. I think any of us that are on the left, socialists, communists, even those of us that are just a little bit left of center, can recognize even at a glance how colonialism played this role, particularly in the fires in Maui. But this will give us some analysis here and give us some more details about the fire itself. So we'll jump into the reading here, guys. Unfortunately, I was not able to highlight a lot of this due to some kind of weird glitch with my highlighter app here. It makes it all distorted. So I'm going to be reading a lot of this, but I'll try to skip through different parts that are not necessary for the analysis or wider discussion. All right. So jumping in here, says fires have been raging across Hawaii's Maui Island since Tuesday night. It is already the second deadliest wildfire in United States history, with 270 structures and 2,000 acres burned, 55 people dead. So an addendum here, guys, this is an older article from, let's see, August 11th. This is an older article. The number of dead is well over 100 now. And they are still digging through some of the ruins and debris and things like that as well, and searching the ocean, because a lot of the people that were fleeing the fires, they went out in the ocean. I read an account of a guy that was out swimming in pretty deep part of the sea for, he said, like 12 hours or something like that. I couldn't imagine having to choose between burning to death in your home, in your community, or taking your chances in the tide around Hawaii. And, you know, the surf in Hawaii is pretty notoriously strong. So that's why so many people surf there, obviously. And 11,000 people without power. More than 11,000 people were evacuated on Wednesday, says Hawaii Department of Transportation Director Ed Snifen. The population of Maui is 164,000. Says here, the fires are especially horrifying because Hawaii is not a natural fire ecosystem and has not evolved to rebound after wildfires. Not surprisingly, preliminary reports suggest climate change is partly to blame, and this is, of course, the case with all these natural disasters. This is why we're seeing the prevalency of floods, fires, desertification, sandstorms, these derecho, large summer storms that are devoid of rain. They're just, you know, pretty much giant dust storms. All these things are a result of climate change and the heating of the planet. Climate change is partly to blame, since the intense winds of Hurricane Dora traveled hundreds of miles to reach the island. It says there's an increasing trend in the intensity of hurricanes worldwide, in part because warm air holds more water. And I imagine, you know, these hurricanes create these large wind storms, and then when some of these winds traveled through the Pacific, specifically to Maui, to Hawaii, all that wind blowing through the different ecosystems, I'm sure, played a large role in drying out a lot of these areas, especially in these areas where they were talking about that there's a non-native grass that easily dries out, right? Like out west, a lot of these forest fires are caused by the prevalency of the amount of pine needles and how dry it gets because of the rising temperatures, drier than even it would have been in a historically dry area. And then these pine needles, I mean, you get large piles of them. If you've ever hiked in Colorado or anywhere that's a kind of fire zone, these needles, they will just pile up and pile up, and that sun just cooks them all day, and then eventually they'll spark. And as we'll talk about, one of the reasons why we're also seeing some of this wildfires increase is the banning or the lack of use of indigenous land management practices like controlled burning. In our article later, we'll discuss some of that with a particular emphasis on Australia. So, yeah, you know, these winds from the hurricanes, tropical storms and stuff, they dry out a lot of it if there's no rain to come with it, and it just sucks the moisture out of the ground, and then it's a powder keg waiting to pop, right? It says, and there's another culprit, the widespread non-native grasses that have taken over certain parts of the island. This is something you may have heard discussed in the mainstream media and the news media with the incessant coverage of this. but you probably didn't hear them have a larger discussion about colonialism as a whole. And these next couple of paragraphs kind of outline this example in particular, and then we'll have more later on. These invasive species like guinea grass were introduced to Hawaii by 19th century settlers who forcibly shifted the land away from indigenous resource management practices and towards large-scale agriculture, such as cattle ranching and plantations like the Dole Pineapple Company. The historic changes to the plants and the vegetation is really what's making us vulnerable and susceptible to events like this. Clay, a specialist in wildland fire science and management at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, told the San Francisco Chronicle. The plantations were then abandoned, allowing the non-native grass to spread from their bounds. The fire problem is mostly attributable to the vast extents of non-native grass left unmanaged by large landowners as we've entered a post-plantation era starting around the 1990s. The number of wildfires Hawaii experienced rose dramatically in the same area. In the same era, sorry. A 2021 study in the journal Perspectives in Plant Ecology, Evolution, and Systematics similarly concludes that large-scale monocropping led to the rapid loss and degradation of native ecosystems through increasing dominance by non-native plants, and that these plants have contributed to the frequency and strength of fires. Plants native to Hawaii, on the other hand, have been shown to be beneficial in limiting wildfires. So a couple of things here. You know, as we're going through this, guys, it is causing me to harken back or recall one of our more recent videos that we did talking about the rise of industrial agriculture and sort of neo-feudalism in the Midwest in particular. We did emphasis on, and here in Iowa, in that video I talked about, you know, I've been an activist on the front lines of the fight against industrial agriculture for a long time. And I mean, this is all a part and parcel to colonialism as well. Literally anything involving land use in the United States, it's being a settler colony, is going to have a direct lineage or tie or legacy to colonialism, right? But it's a very similar thing here with the, you know, destruction of land, the ripping up of the soil, the destruction of native plants, the draining of bogs and swamps and wetlands and things like that in order to create large swaths of arable land for monoculture crops, i.e. here in Iowa, corn and soybeans, right? In Hawaii, it was different things like sugarcane, pineapple, and other fruits, right? But the process is the same. It is the destruction of, you know, native indigenous peoples' agriculture and land management and ecosystem management to create really what amounts to a desert, a food desert, a biodiversity desert. I mean, if you think about like the landscape, for instance, here in Iowa, it is just hectare after hectare of corn and soybeans that are artificially irrigated. And what we talked about in our previous video is how even some of the buffer zones, the hedgerows, the little bit of wetlands between the fields and the irrigation dikes and the drainage dikes has been completely ripped up. So one of the things that we're experiencing is 700 waterways that are completely destroyed by pesticides, heavy metals, insecticides, and nitrates from fertilizer, nitrogen and phosphorus, which is caused you know, wells to be polluted from runoff from the waterways, high rates of breast cancer in rural areas, all kinds of diseases. But not only that, the result of this colonial, you know, capitalist farming practice has also created a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is, you know, hundreds of square miles where no life can exist because all the oxygen has been sucked out of it due to the nitrate and pesticide pollution. So all these things are all interwoven, right, with colonial practices of land management that are extremely destructive, right? And that's what we're seeing here in Hawaii is the spread of this grass, the draining of wetlands, no doubt. You know, ostensibly they would say to take care of, you know, pests like mosquitoes and stuff like that, or to siphon the water away from areas so it could be tilled, or to siphon the water to be used for irrigation. All of these things create absolutely devastating impacts on environments, and not just environments, but on agricultural land too. I mean, you go back in time and look at the 1930s, the Dust Bowl, you know, poor soil management, poor ecosystem management created the Dust Bowl. We had these huge dust storms where, you know, during several years of drought, which is normal, we're going to go through droughts. After several years of drought, large storms ripped up the loose topsoil that was no longer saturated with water to keep it held down. You know, I mean, there's a long legacy now, a couple hundred years of these sort of practices just destroying. not just individual ecosystems, but the planet as a whole, right? Let's see what else we got here, guys. Again, I'm sorry if the reading's a little mismatched and out of place, and I have to kind of sift through some stuff. Again, I was unable to highlight like I usually do. We have Kaniela Ng, a former Hawaiian legislator and current director of the Green New Deal Network, tweeted that the gross mismanagement of land by greedy developers and land speculators destroyed our natural landscapes and buffers and enabled the rapid spread of the fire. Again, what we were just talking about. The International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC's sixth and latest report, explains that colonialism has exacerbated climate change. And apparently, I think this was back in 22, apparently this is the first time that the Panel on Climate Change explicitly, in its report, explicitly mentioned colonialism as one of the main exacerbating, as it said here, forces behind climate change. Up to that point, we had only just begun to see some experts and scientists and people on panels like the IPCC discussing capitalism as a cause of climate change. Now we're beginning to see these officials and experts build on that and tie colonialism and the relationship between capitalism and colonialism together with what's causing climate change, right? Let's see here. It says, the report says that colonized areas are more likely to face worse climate disasters and linked to studies that show direct connections between environmental damage and robbing indigenous communities of their land. Others have argued that colonialism is the direct cause of climate change, and I would agree with that wholeheartedly, citing a fundamental societal value that motivated both colonial action and environmental degradation. We have quotes here, says, instead of treating the earth like a precious entity that gives us life, Western colonial legacies operate within a paradigm that assumes they can extract its natural resources as much as they want, and the earth will regenerate itself, said Hadil Asali, a lecturer and postdoctoral scholar at Columbia Center for Science and Society. The fires are particularly tragic because this colonial background continues the history of harm against Kanaka Maoli, the native Hawaiian people. The fires have wiped out Lahaina, which was once the capital of the Hawaiian kingdom, an important cultural and historical epicenter. Our ancestors, especially Native Hawaiians, fought them every step of the way. It is also a reminder of that history of resistance, Ng told NBC News on August 9th. So along the way with this absolutely crazy hellscape of a fire that really, really, it's affecting a lot of Hawaii, but specifically Lahaina was, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sorry if I'm not, guys. It also wiped away a bunch of indigenous, history and sacred areas and things like that. And again, this is what we obviously see with colonialism as well, is not just the destruction of the lands that native peoples depend on, but their culture, their way of life, their history, their sacred places along the way as well. So that's what I have here for this article, guys. Just kind of quick and succinct and kind of greases the wheels a little bit for a wider discussion on how colonialism is behind a lot of this ecological crisis, right? So a few things I want to talk about before we go into the press release from the White House in regards to colonialism. So we read through that article. We get a little taste of the perspective of how colonialism may have caused these fires in Maui, how, if it didn't necessarily cause them, it exacerbated them and caused them to be more widespread, right? So you can kind of see the link there. You had plantation owners, settlers come in, tear up the land, redirect water sources, drain bogs and things like that. They came with this non-native grass that's extremely flammable. And then years later, generations later, it creates this sort of powder keg and environment that's not used to these kind of fires, where they're having these kind of fires all the time. And there's no way for the ecosystem or the communities to adapt. So you can see the sort of timeline and the web of connections there as to how colonialism caused this. But I want to kind of zoom out really quick and have a brief but wider discussion that will grease the wheels for another article later on after we do the White House press release, right? You may be thinking, oh, well, this is capitalism that's causing this, right? This is capitalism. This is industrial agriculture, mass markets, real estate development. This is capitalism causing this ecological crisis. And you're right to a degree, but I want to kind of look at how colonialism and capitalism are completely interwoven, right? Lenin's Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, talks about how, you know, imperialism is a absolutely necessary part. Militarism is an absolutely necessary part of capitalism. Capitalist societies cannot exist without constantly expanding to new markets and new resource hubs, right? Going along with that, it's important to realize that capitalism, as we know it, that is industrial capitalism, industrial markets, proletariat versus bourgeoisie, everything that you can think of with capitalism, could not have started or got going at the breadth and width across the world that it did without colonialism first setting the stage, right? Now, why do I say that? It goes back to what we were talking about with Lenin's Imperialism, Highest Stage of Capitalism, right? Capitalism, industrialization, the excess capital that was necessary to create the factories, advance the sciences, and the networkings and the bureaucracy necessary for a highly advanced industrial capitalist society could not have existed without the mass primitive accumulation that occurred during the colonial period from 1492 onwards. You could even zoom back a little bit further if you look at England's relationship with Ireland, Scotland, and things like that, right? Or the Norman French invasion of England and all that. I mean, that's a discussion for another day, maybe something you can look into yourself. But at the end of the day, the root capital that allowed for the development of industrial capitalism as we know it today could not have been created, could not have formed in just feudal Europe by itself. It's impossible. Europe does not have enough resources or people power to have developed capitalism, certainly not at the rate or exponential growth that we associate it with through the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, right? If they had not gone out and colonized the entire known world and engaged in that primitive accumulation, that stealing of land, that stealing of resources, the stealing of literal human beings, the mass exploitation of slave labor that we associate with the quote-unquote age of exploration, the age of colonialism, right? All of that set the stage for capitalism to the level that we have it today, right? So, yes, industrial capitalism has played, obviously, with like the fossil fuel industry, chemical production, militarism, industrial complex production, all of these things are, of course, part and parcel to the climate catastrophe, to environmental degradation. But none of that could have been built, that the castle of industrial capitalism, of militarism, of United States Empire, European Empire, could not have been built up on if it didn't have the base of colonialism, the mass theft and destruction, right? So going along with that discussion, going along with that understanding, we need to realize a few different things, right? We need to realize that colonialism kind of springs up and develops sort of like this alongside colonialism. Step by step by step, right? Colonialism comes into an area, you know, the colonial powers come into one area and they have all this land and vast resources. When they came, they were looking for things like gold, right? Well, they didn't always find gold. So they said, well, how do we make this venture profitable, right? Oh, we can clear cut forests for logs. Oh, we didn't find gold, but we found silver or we found tin, as in the case of like the Spanish conquistadors in South America, particularly in Bolivia, right? Another great example is like the mountain men and the French fur trappers in Canada, right? So when you think about, that's like kind of the classic quintessential thing you think of with the colonial period is like the fur trappers and the mountain men. Wow, what a rustic lifestyle, the life of adventure and explorer. Well, you got to think about it like this, guys. At that time, no one gave a fuck about beaver pelts. No one gave a fuck about beaver pelts. That was not on the radar of any, there's no one fucking special with that. You had European feudal monarchs and the oligarchy wearing silk from along the Silk Road in China and trade over there and trade with China. I mean, you know, no one gave a fuck about beaver pelts, right? But this natural resource was there in the indigenous communities, in the indigenous environment, in this vast landscape. You had beaver pelts. So tons of them, fur pelts in general, right? So colonialism came, the people are here, they're setting up colonies and stuff, and they say, well, how can we exploit this however frick possible? What's here to exploit, right? They see these furs and they say, well, nobody fucking wants that. We need to create a need for it. And if you go throughout all of colonial and capitalist history, time and time and time again, it's not that the colonialists came here and stayed here because of a specific resource or product. It was they made the need or made the desire for the product. So with the beaver pelts, it came up with the beaver pelt hats, the top hats and things like that, and it became a mass market after the colonialism had already began, right? So you have colonialism, you have the fur trapping, okay, we're going to sell it. Then you have the capitalism, the manufacturing of these things, we're going to sell it, make it into a commodity that everybody wants, right? And you'll see that time and time and time again throughout history. Another example is like the buffalo, right? The use of the furs and the meat for the buffalo. So, you know, for Western European colonialists in the Americas, none of those people initially wanted to fucking eat buffalo. You know, they have their European palate with their European dispossession towards tastes or whatever, pork, beef, whatever it might be, right? They have European palates, right? But you had colonialists, settlers going further and further out west, deeper and deeper into the North American continent, and they see millions, they see literal oceans of buffalo, and they say, well, fuck, let's find a way to commodify that, right? So they created this huge meat market and fur market and bone market for the buffalo because the colonialists, it was already there. Here's a resource, even though we don't know, even though we know no one wants it, we don't know how initially to exploit it. We have to think about it. Let's find a way to create a need, a market around this thing. Okay, so colonialism, again, first step, right? We're here. Here's a resource. Let's exploit it. And then capitalism creates the market for it and vice versa, right? So they created this, you know, massive demand for buffalo meat, for buffalo furs, more specifically for the bones, because the bones could be ground down and then mixed in with other ingredients to create a fertilizer of some sort, right? So they create, colonialists created the demand for it. So while we're talking about the buffalo, it's also important to consider this, how colonialism has created this climate catastrophe. It wasn't just because they came in and brought invasive species or changed the landscape so that they could do monocrop culture, tobacco, cotton, sugar, et cetera, all the stuff, you know. It wasn't just to do that. It was also to destroy the land that indigenous communities all over the world, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, North America, anywhere, everywhere, were dependent on, right? This is how and why we say it's not just capitalism that has created this ecological crisis. It's colonialism. It's settler colonialism going up to today in the modern rendition, 21st century United States. It's still a settler colony. It's not like colonialism is in the past. It still exists today. The very existence of the United States is a testament to the reality that people of the world are still living under colonialism. It's not something that disappeared after World War II with the Third World National Liberation Movements. We still live in this world today. That's what Israel is. That's what North America is. That's what Canada is, just a fucking mining company with the name of a country on it, right? So this is what we're talking about, is these colonialists, before capitalism was even a thing, they had a vested interest in ethnically cleansing, in, you know, instituting a genocide against indigenous people. What's the best way to do that? Indigenous people are oftentimes nomadic, or they are reliant on the lands, on the very lands that they themselves had cultivated. Things like the Amazon rainforest, the Great Plains, the, you know, Pacific Northwest rainforest. These are all ecosystems that didn't just exist and come about, you know, naturally through magic or the hidden hand of nature. They were cultivated and protected and carried along by indigenous communities for agricultural reasons and for communal reasons, right? That's something that's completely left out of the discussion of, you know, Western conservation efforts, right? All these beautiful landscapes that people love were created and fostered and carried along by indigenous communities, and just by the very nature of their relationship with the land. And obviously, the colonial settlers understood this fact. And so they had a vested interest not just to reap as many resources as possible from the land, but to destroy the land by any means necessary so that the people that were dependent on that land could no longer live on it. Because the colonialists weren't necessarily dependent on the land. They could get food imports from the homeland, from the imperial core. they could do their cash crops and stuff that destroyed the land and then sell it and then get whatever they needed. Indigenous people didn't have that luxury, right? They're 100% dependent on land. So like I was saying, going back to the buffalo story, it wasn't just that they created this market for it because we're going to figure out a way to make money while we're engaging in colonial practices. They realized that if we remove the number one food source for the Plains Indians tribes, we can get rid of them. We can literally cleanse them from the earth, right? And you'll see this time and time again throughout the whole world of colonial powers, be it the British, the Germans, the French, purposefully destroying, degrading, or redirecting the use of a land in such a way that it keeps indigenous people off of it because they can no longer sustain their native ways, their age-old ways of living amongst the colonial system. So these are some important things to consider when you're looking at the ecological crisis. This has been going on for several hundred years now, and we are sitting in the driver's seat of a hyper-accelerated capitalism built on these colonial practices of apartheid and genocide that destroyed the land, right? So that's just something I want to touch on there before we move on to the next part of this episode, right? So before we move on with the discussion centered around colonialism and how it has created the climate crisis, we're going to take a quick little break with that, and we're going to kind of touch just briefly, because I'm sure you guys are interested in this, what some of the things that the Biden-Harris administration is doing for the Maui wildfires. So this is, of course, the White House press release. I just wanted to bring this up to you guys because while we're discussing colonialism, I want you to get an idea of the response of the federal government, right? Of the federal government of the settler colony, right? Talks about federal personnel being sent to Maui to assist residents, the use of the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Navy, FEMA coming in, has deployed more than 140 urban search and rescue personnel, FEMA bringing meals, water, blankets, things like that, essential needs. Here's another key one that I'm sure you've heard discussed in the news, at least to some degree. People, a lot of the people in Maui might even have an image from a interview, are upset about this. So these people have had their, not just their homes and their livelihoods destroyed, but literally for the native Hawaiians, their culture incinerated in this fire. It says FEMA has authorized critical needs assistance. Excuse me, guys. CNA, which provides a one-time payment of $700 per household to applicants who were displaced from their homes and have critical needs. $700 just a household. So that doesn't go for anyone that's unhoused. And Hawaii is going through a very serious, like the rest of us, a very serious housing crisis because Hawaii is actually the most expensive state in the union. Keep that in mind. Most expensive state in the union. $700 one-time payment. No guarantee of anything else. Right. That's all they're fucking getting after having their entire lives destroyed. Many of them being Native Hawaiians, subject to colonial rule of the United States Empire. $700. That's all you get. I mean, just the amount of money they should be getting in reparations alone for the, legacy of colonialism and the complete destruction of their culture, overthrowing of their monarchy, their tribal, you guys know what I'm trying to say. Insane. The amount of reparations they should be getting alone for that should be in the tens of thousands of dollars, you know, every year. $700 one-time payment to deal with a fucking ecological crisis. Small Business Administration has dozens of staff in the island also going along with this, making low-interest federal disaster loans. Loans. Not just really, in a functioning fucking society, no matter where you're at in a functioning fucking country, if there's a crisis that is literally no fault of your own, a natural disaster, don't you think your government should help you fucking rebuild? Aren't you a citizen in the society, a member of the supposed body politique of people that elect the government? Why the fuck aren't you taking care of me? Why aren't you helping me just flat out rebuild my house? What's going on here? That's a functioning fucking society. No, in the United States, banker fucking oligarchy, you get a low interest federal disaster loan. And again, low interest. Maybe I would get it if it was a loan that you paid back with zero interest, but low interest. I wonder how fucking low the interest is. Then obviously you have the American Red Cross here, supplemental nutrition, SNAP, EBT for people, different specialists, pretty much sending a bunch of personnel. Nowhere in here is a discussion of the legacy of colonialism. Nowhere in here is obviously, I shouldn't even have to say this, but nowhere in here is discussion of land back. Nowhere in here is a discussion of looking at the lasting impacts of some of these colonial policies that have created, like, the invasive species problem or how to take care of that. There has been some discussion on revamping the ailing electrical grid on this island, which they say may have contributed to the fires. But again, you know, that's also part of colonialism. That's also part of imperialism, is Hawaii has become this thing. Initially, it was a territory where they're extracting resources out of it. They're sucking value out of it, right, and bringing it back to the mainland. And then in exchange, what do they get? They don't even get decent infrastructure. I mean, obviously, similar case of what you saw in Puerto Rico. I mean, and now especially getting into this time period with real estate investment and the huge boom of the tourist trade, this is just colonialism taking a different form, a more cleaner, beautified, travel sort of veneer with it, right? But it's still the process of colonialism, sucking value. The tourism industry would be one thing if the actual indigenous communities got the wealth out of it and we're able to decide what they want to do with that wealth. But of course, that's not what happens. It's large multinational hospitality corporations, your Marriott's, your Hilton's, things like that, sucking resources, employing the people there, the indigenous people there, for poverty wages, sucking all the resources out back to some, you know, offshore bank account, or sucking it back to the imperial core, right? So I just wanted to touch on this here, guys, because this is again, a Band-Aid, and this is what we are going to see continually, is Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid until the whole fucking country is covered in Band-Aids while it fucking burns to the ground, right? This is not a solution at all. Now, I'm going to move on from the White House press release here, because I'm sure if any of you guys have been following this story, a lot of the stuff you guys already kind of know. I just wanted to touch on a little bit for those of you who maybe haven't read into what the response is, why a lot of people have a problem with the response. But I also obviously wanted to tie it to larger discussion of colonialism and how nothing, obviously, that the United States government, the federal government, the empire does is going to meaningfully address the systems of exploitation and colonial destruction that have caused these problems and are going to continue to cause these problems. So with that, as we continue this discussion, I want to jump into this next article here. This is from the University of Columbia. State of the Planet, Columbia Climate School, Climate Earth Society. Great resource here, great little article that gives us more examples of how colonialism has created this ecological crisis. Just about any ecological crisis you can think of, from plastic and chemical pollution to desertification to floods, all of it, right? How colonialism spawned and continues to exacerbate the climate crisis. I was actually able to highlight this one, thankfully. Says here, we currently live in an epoch that geologists call the Holocene, which began soon after the last major ice age ended around 11,700 years ago. But for over two decades, some scientists have argued that the label is far too antiquated. In 2000, the term Anthropocene, anthropo for human and scene for new, gained prominence. It highlights how human activities dominate the Earth's land, atmosphere, and oceans, significantly impacting its climate and natural ecosystems. And like we talked about earlier, a lot of these beautiful landscapes that we take for granted or associate with wild spaces were in fact cultivated and carried along by indigenous people, right? So even 11,700 years ago, during the so-called start of this age, you know, humans were engaging and changing their environment, but they were engaging and changing it in a way that you could call beneficial, in ways that actually created more biodiversity or created better living ecosystems for humans to, exist in. The problem, some scholars say, is that the term assumes the climate crisis is caused by universal human nature rather than the actions of a minority of colonialists, capitalists, and patriarchs. And the implication that the Earth was stable until around 1950, when the Anthropocene supposedly began, denies a history of people who have been exploited by those systems for centuries. So this actually touches on another video too that we did in the past. Maybe you can, I can't remember which one it was. I mean, you can kind of read the headers and know what we're going to be talking about, right? But we kind of threw mud in the face of this cynical Malthusian argument that human beings are the cause of the ecological crisis and that human beings just devour and they're a plague and they're going to destroy the planet. You know, we talked about how capitalism in that episode is what's causing this, that it's a handful of people with a vested interest in the status quo that are causing it. It's not human beings in general, right? Going on here, guys, says rising global inequalities. By 2008, countries in Asia and Africa gained independence from their colonial empires, which had by then returned to their homelands. And yet, colonialism is still not a thing of the past. It continues to oppress developing nations and minority communities globally, from West Africa to Libya, Palestine to Ukraine. Yeah, I don't agree with you there, buddy. To places like Kashmir that are facing subjugation under military occupation. Present developmental changes causing high vulnerability are influenced by historical ongoing patterns of inequity such as colonialism, especially for many indigenous peoples and local communities, report said. This is that same IPCC report we were talking about earlier. Officials and scientists from around the globe now recognize the significant role colonialism has played in heating our planet and destroying its many gifts. Colonialism was motivated by the promise of plundering the environment and subjugating populations, and the pervasive and persistent institutions of colonialism make it far more challenging to address the climate crisis and implement solutions. And obviously, guys, a part of this isn't just the things we've talked about. It's the unwillingness for the global north, the historically colonial powers, imperialist powers, that's Europe and the United States explicitly, to pay reparations in the form of climate investment to the global south. And we've talked about this before as well, that like, no matter, let's say everything goes perfect in the global north, everything goes perfect in the United States and Europe, and it's not, to address climate change, and they do everything 100% renewable, completely ban plastic, everything. Just imagine a fucking green utopia in the global north, a green capitalist utopia, whatever fucking bullshit that looks like. Imagine all that. That don't fucking matter if you ain't done it for the other 90% of human beings on the planet that are going to be stuck in these outdated modes of production that don't allow them to transition from this old way of industrial capitalism to a greener future. Right. It's not going to do shit. The planet's still going to burn to death, but you'll just be doing it in front of a bunch of fucking solar panels and nice trees in your yard. Right. Let's see here. This is an important part here too as well, guys. It says 2021 study published in Nature highlighted that research is less likely to investigate climate change impacts in the global south, even though those 78 low-income countries are facing the worst impacts. They are also the least responsible for climate warming emissions. Big thing here, guys. The entire continent of Africa accounts for the lowest share of greenhouse gas emissions at 3.8%. In contrast, the U.S. and European Union are responsible for 19% and 13% of global emissions, respectively. And I wonder if that even addresses historically, because this brings me to a point of what you're hearing a lot in the imperialist news right now of, the West, particularly the United States, is doing fucking almost nothing about climate change, especially in regards to like what we're talking about here, helping the global south for this transition and to, protect themselves from some of the inevitable effects of climate change that we are sailing right down past and it's too late to stop, flooding and burns, doing nothing to help, doing nothing meaningful to actually transition away from a fossil fuel dependent economy, despite what fucking Biden says. They're not. Right, but what they're, you'll see the U.S. shifting its blame like it always does, always with everything, shifting the blame onto countries like China. And they're saying, oh, China is the largest carbon emitter now. Or despite being the largest carbon emitter, China is doing very little to address this. That's a complete fucking fabrication. That's not even just a half truth. That's a fucking lie. Because yes, China is the biggest carbon emitter now. But historically, despite there being 1.4 fucking billion people in China, historically, China has contributed single-digit percentage points towards the total global emissions of carbon, right? Historically, especially if you factor in those the colonial legacy of environmental destruction we're talking about, which contributes to carbon emissions, the United States and Europe is light, like literally the rest of the world, the rest of the human species from China to Africa to anywhere in Asia to Latin America has nothing to do with climate change. They did nothing to contribute to it. It is all the United States. It is all the European powers historically, right? There's actually a really great analysis that Ben Norton did, and I wish I had the grasp for you. We have enough to cover here today, where he outlines the historical legacy of carbon emissions and puts all this into numbers and graphs for you to show how little China's contributed, right? So this is the sort of hypocrisy you're seeing. And again, here, 3.8% for the entire continent of Africa compared to the United States, 19%, right? Just absolutely insane, guys. give me 1 second here, guys. Any more when I do this? My throat gets so raw talking. It's probably because I vape way too much, but all right. Goddamn. All right. Thanks for bearing with me there, guys. So this next section, guys, the colonial roots of desertification and deforestation. By the end of the 19th century, French colonizers in North and West Africa banned rural communities from practicing their centuries-old subsistence farming methods. That soon led to extensive environmental degradation. The locals were forced to chop down forests to make way for cotton plantations and other cash crops throughout the French Equatorial Africa, French Afrique, which is under serious siege right now and is really on the verge of collapse due to, you know, new third world national liberation movements. It's pretty crazy to see. And France is just seething, man. They're just plugged into that copium right now. Which extended from the Congo River into the Sahel. So this is, again, what we're talking about, only this time in Africa. The colonial practices of cash cropping and destruction of land, just this is what it was, the cornerstone for the climate catastrophe now, right? As the soils of these regions lost moisture and the land started to lose its vegetation, a French colonial forester coined the term desertification. The colonizers then blamed the land management practices of migratory tribes and other indigenous people, as if they hadn't been doing that for tens of thousands of years. The fucking audacity and hubris of the French to be like, oh, what? These dirty browns are causing this land to dry up. And they're meanwhile, they're just clear-cutting forests and burning everything in order to plant tobacco and cotton. And like, why is the land turning to shit? Those fucking browns must have done some kind of curse or something. Insane, man. Just insane. The indigenous way of life does not match this idea of Western imposed private property and cash crop farming that the colonizers had implemented by force, said Asali. To date, history is repeating itself in the southern region of Palestine. The Palestinian population that once lived and farmed the area was expelled largely to the Gaza Strip, and the region is now facing widespread desertification after the Israeli government diverted the Jordan River and uprooted innumerable native olive trees. Some of those olive trees had been there for thousands of years, too. During the early stages of the founding of the State of Israel and the displacement of indigenous Palestinian communities, a joint Israeli-Australian project planted thousands of eucalyptus trees instead of native trees and vegetations as an effort to dry the swamps of southern Palestine. Again, before we go on with this, I just want to say, this cash crop farming, like the way that we, and we touched on this actually in the industrial agricultural video, the way that we visualize agriculture is not necessary. Agriculture does not have to be this economic giant that you're thinking of, right? And a lot of the reason why industrial agriculture is the way it is in the United States isn't because it does anything to feed anybody. It's because it props up the ethanol industry for gasoline and cars, and corn feed for industrial meat production. But not just that, it's like that because these large multinational US-based agro businesses wanted to make American US agricultural exports competitive on the global market, right? But agriculture does not have to be this way. At its root, agriculture should be about feeding people. And guess what? Corn feed for cows and soya beans for oils and things like that and ethanol and all this, doesn't fucking feed people, right? Carrots, tomatoes, potatoes, onions, sweet corn, you name it, feeds people, bitch. Wheat, rice, radishes, I don't fucking know. This is what feeds people. None of that shit you see on the side of the highway when you're traveling feeds anybody other than a few cows, right? And the meat's not fucking good for you because it's so anyway, fuck. Let's go on here before I go on a tangent. Because, again, like I said, I've been on the front lines of this issue for a long time, and it's sensitive to me, you know? So talking about these planting of eucalyptus trees, guys, says that was a means of dispossessing people from their land because the eucalyptus trees dried out all their ancient water wells and other water sources, added Asali. Even though Israel claims to be environmentally sustainable and innovative, in fact, one of its founding myths is that it made the desert bloom. They're actively causing the desertification of Palestine and using the land for exploitative purposes. So with this talking about Israel v. Palestine, this is what we're talking about with North America. Land use practices that are purposefully meant to displace populations, right? This is a part of colonialism. This is why, in a sense, colonialism should be looked at as the larger perpetuator of climate destruction, i.e., as compared to, say, industrial capitalism. They both, I mean, you can't talk about one without the other, but this is an important context that I think people need to understand, right? Settler colonialism had similarly devastating impacts on the forest cover and biodiversity of New Zealand. According to Decolonial Atlas, in 1840, European settlers started confiscating land from the Maori tribes and took over most of the country by 1939. The main goal of the colonizers was to extract as much timber as possible from the forests, because they went there and they said, what is there that we can make money off of? The wood. Just a little thing here. Present day, New Zealand has at least 60% fewer forests than before European colonialization. I mean, and that's what this, I'll scroll back up. That's what this is an image of here. Just insane, guys. And it's a similar story with North America, obviously. Going on here, guys. So that's desertification. I mean, this is a direct result of colonialism and colonial practices that continue today. The lasting impacts of colonial conservation. Oh, hang on here, guys. Just want to. In Australia in the late 1700s, British colonizers banned the centuries-old indigenous practice of controlled burning in southern Australia. Controlled burning involves low-intensity fires on forest floors. Indigenous fire management can effectively get rid of thick layers of dry vegetation on the forest floors that becomes highly flammable. I won't read the rest of that section there, but a couple things. One, this is also a large part of what's caused the fires out west is in the older times when there was not settlers in the west, i.e., these dry areas, you know, your Montanas, your Colorados, your Wyomings. You had indigenous people passing through there according to animal migrations and things like that. But they would also, you know, gather and even engage in some agricultural practices, subsistence agriculture. They weren't doing these large-scale productions like how necessarily we were, at least not in North America. You could go down to, Latin America, in the Mayan or the Aztec empires, and they did do maybe more intensive agriculture, but even that was still in conjunction with the land in a healthier way. But along the way for North American indigenous people, they would do these controlled burns because it would affect the migration patterns of animals. It would help propagate other beneficial, you know, herbs or foodstuffs that they would use as they pass through there according to the season. While nowadays you do see some, you know, Western colonial conservation efforts doing controlled burns, it's not happening at the scale or regularity or in the same type of patterns that indigenous people have been doing for thousands of years, right? So you're seeing that out west. Of course, you're seeing it here in Australia. And while we're talking about Australia, if you remember, I guess it's probably been 4 years back now, those really, really bad fires in Australia that, I mean, don't insane. It was like the end of the world. That was like the moment I was like, fuck, climate change is bad, right? Like, this is worse than I thought for me. So when you think about Australia, one of the things you think about is the eucalyptus tree, or you think about the koalas,
right?
And how many of them there are there? Well, there never actually used to be that many of them. I mean, there was a healthy population, but them being such a normalized figurehead thing in Australia is because of the large industrial production of eucalyptus, like what we talked about in the article with Israel. You know, Australian settlers purposefully grew that eucalyptus, one, because they used it for different things, but also because it dried out the wells that the Aborigine people were using. And so those koalas that you see on all those eucalyptus trees, because they love the eucalyptus, that's all artificially made, and it was a part and parcel, a process of colonization. And it's also played a major role in causing those huge wildfires. I mean, it's not just that, but that's a part of it, right? Industrial cash crop colonial practices of agriculture, right? We'll skip through that. It says in the last 2 years, intensity of wildfires in southern Australia has increased tenfold. In comparison, wildfires have been less catastrophic in the northern parts of the country where controlled burning was never banned. Similarly, India's western Himalaya region, beginning in the late 1800s, the British cut down most oak and deodar forests for commercial purposes. Where do you think all those big commercial ships came from, those wood sail ships? Then they replaced those native forests, which were resistant to wildfires, with large-scale pine plantations for procuring resin. Every summer, dry pine needles are responsible for massive wildfires in several parts of the Indian Himalayas. Again, going back to what we talked about here in North America as well. Environmental destruction could be traced back to colonialism and imperialism. To some extent, the present-day conservation interventions are part of these colonial legacies. This is why we talk so much about land back, guys. And returning large swathes of these wild spaces back to the sovereignty of indigenous people, because they have the ancestral and historical knowledge and cultural and spiritual relationship and understanding with the land that, quite frankly, no matter how fucking hippie you are, is devoid of actual substance in Western cultures. Look, and it's just how it fucking is. You know, our more naturally tried spiritual cultural connection to wild spaces, to nature, was wiped away during the process of Christianization of pagans in the early Middle Ages, right? And it's not there. Like it's developing. I don't want to be completely racist against whites. But this is why we talk about land back, beyond the fact that it's the right fucking thing to do. These communities know how to take care of this. They know how to get us out of this climate crisis in a way that, you know, rational, scientific, consumerist white societies can't, right? They just can't. Let's see here. To some extent, the present day, a lot of conservation products bring in outsiders to make hyperbolic decisions. Again, this is why we're talking about land back. They end up making things worse because they have rarely consulted that region's rural and indigenous peoples. Right. We see this a lot. We see people try to come in and fix it, and they make it way fucking worse. West further pointed out that in South Africa, British colonizers promoted the idea of protected areas to mainly focus on wild animals they could hunt down as trophies. This white colonial ideology of protected areas dictates that certain places in the world should be human-free to be considered wild, that these places are only meant to be gazed upon. I'm not going to read any more from that section. But this whole Western idea of conservation, people don't realize that a lot of this, like, that came out of, like, say, Teddy Roosevelt and other conservationists in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The guys pushing this idea were deeply fucking white supremacists, deeply fucking racist, and some of them were even advocates of eugenicism when it was an early rendition of the eugenic science. I mean, these people were deeply racist. And the whole idea of having a national park where humans are never at, and it's just a wildlife, it's just a wild, that's not part of fucking reality and has not been for 10,000 years. And like we talked about, indigenous communities built up a lot of these wild places and helped protect them, right? And during that time, the whole idea of some of these conservationists was like, we want to go in there, we want to literally scalp, Like, they were, government was paying for Indian scalps to purge these areas of native people who have been living on it for thousands of years so that they could turn it into a giant fucking amusement park for white people. That's the legacy of the national parks. It's not this beautiful kumbaya nature hippy-dippy shit you think it is. It's fucking racist eugenicism. Straight out. And that's the same case, a very similar case in Africa with these, you know, wildlife preserves. Now, like, look, is it better, I guess, to have a wildlife preserve even in this Western colonial system than to have mass destruction and exploitative mining and poaching? I guess maybe. But a lot of times you have to look carefully between the lines with this shit because it's not always what you think it is. A lot of times it will be white Westerners, colonial powers, using wildlife protection, save the cheetahs, save the zebras, save the rhinos, to come into an indigenous area, get all the indigenous people out, displace them, manufacturing the consent for that process through, we're going to save the wildlife and these people are hurting the wildlife because of the whatever, whatever. But then a few years later, once that preserve has been set up, you'll see the government, which these governments are colonial, neo-colonial governments propped up by Western regimes, they will have Western corporations, mining corporations, plantation corporations come in and get rights to this land, right? So the protection of the wildlife, save the wildlife, is used as an excuse to come in and then extract resources from the land, right? Manufacturing of consent, right? So this is a little bit of history of the so-called conservation that we have in the West, right? honestly, guys, I think I'm just going to round it off here. Some of this is about, you know, plastic pollution and how all these quote-unquote countries that are going green, what they're really doing is they're not actually recycling their shit, including like Germany that's supposed to be famous for its recycling. They're just shipping it overseas, and this is part of colonialism too. If you go around the world, so many human beings live on giant piles of trash. That's our trash. That's not their trash. There's like this mental fuck, mind fuck game going on with white people where they look at, like, say this image here, you know, or you've seen images of people living on giant piles of trash, and they're like, wow, darkies are so dirty. Why are darkies so dirty? Right? And forgive me for being crass here, but this is how people fucking think about it. This isn't my thinking. Why are the brown people so dirty? Wow, they just destroy their environment. They don't realize fucking 90% of that garbage is ours, that we pay these puppet governments to take in, to be processed, and then the indigenous people and third world has to deal with the consequences, the cancers, the diseases, etc. Anyway, guys, that's really all I have for you. I hope some of this has put in perspective, you know, the huge role colonialism has played in the destruction of our world, right? And I know anybody watching this channel is undoubtedly on board about understanding how capitalism and infinite growth on a planet with finite resources is causing climate change, is one of the root causes behind climate change. But I thought maybe it would be valuable to talk about how colonialism and capitalism together are creating this thing part for parcel, step by step together, right? Because I think a lot of times, especially for those of us that are white Westerners, we sometimes forget to look at this from the indigenous perspective, from the colonial perspective, or maybe even sometimes we don't want to, because it's uncomfortable and it makes us realize that our ways of life in our settler colonies, like the United States, South Africa, wherever you are going to have to be fundamentally changed. Our relationship with indigenous communities, with the land, and the way that we use resources is going to have to be fundamentally changed, along with the way in which the relationships around the means of production change as well. Like, it won't be enough. If you're from a white Western settler colony like the United States, it will not be enough to just have a great socialist revolution where the working people of the United States, you know, have control of the means of production. That will not be enough to solve climate change. That will not be enough to overcome the contradictions of the legacy of what the United States Empire is. we cannot overcome these contradictions. And really, we won't even be able to build a socialist revolution unless we have reconciled these contradictions and reached some level of truth and reconciliation with our past of genocidal, apartheid, colonialism in this part of the world. Like, these things are all interwoven, right? And I hope some of this discussion has maybe caused your brain or your mind to think in a way that maybe you've not thought before. Right. So with that, guys, I'll go ahead and round this off here. Drop a comment with your thoughts. Indigenous people, if you're watching, I know there's a few of you who do watch the show. Please add more insight. I know you guys know far more about this than I do. But anybody, really, if you want to add more to this discussion about capitalism versus colonialism and the role it plays with climate change, and what does a more ecological society that's dealt with these contradictions of capitalism and colonialism look like here in, say, North America or wherever you live, you know, drop a comment. Don't be afraid to really type out some paragraphs if you're feeling up to it. Let's get a discussion going. You know, that's what I love about this channel. Other than that, guys, of course, hit subscribe, hit like, share this to your friends, drop those comments for me. And don't forget, you can support my independent media work on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. I mean, it's nothing. If everybody watches the show, gives $1 a month, you won't miss it. I mean, you got that much sitting in your change thing in your fucking car, right? But if 200 people do that, holy shit, you know, I'm doing pretty good. So support me there, or give me a one-time PayPal donation if you can at paypal.me/tubmillennials. Anyway, guys, enough from me. As always, it's great hanging out with you, great talking about the issues with you, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Bye for now.